From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Today, U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis released a statement warning North Korea to stand down in its pursuit of nuclear weapons, adding that it should cease any consideration of actions that will lead to the end of the regime and destruction of its people. It's the latest notch in U.S. tensions with North Korea over its nuclear program. Earlier, North Korea threatened preemptive military strikes against the U.S. as President Trump vowed to unleash fire and fury on the country. John Wolfstahl is former senior director for arms control and nonproliferation at the National Security Council under President Obama. He's now a scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he joins us by Skype. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And what's your reaction to all of this talk going on both sides here?
Well, I think it's really time for both the North Koreans and the Trump administration to take a deep breath and think about where we are. North Korea continues to make steady progress on having nuclear weapons that can reach the United States. And the United States has a longstanding interest in preserving stability and peace in the region and being able to slow down and stop North Korea's program. And none of those things are going to be helped by inflammatory threats or increasing the risk of an escalation. So I think the United States, in particular, President Trump and his administration, need to be thinking about how we reassure our allies and how we establish a firm policy that gets North Korea back to the negotiating table and also establishes a strong deterrent relationship with the North Koreans until their weapons are eliminated.
So was it a mistake for President Trump to use the words he did yesterday, threatening fire and fury?
There's no question that the president's comments took most people aback. Usually what people see from the United States is steady, calm, thoughtful, more measured language. The concern that I think most analysts have is North Korea is a paranoid state. They are convinced the United States is out to eliminate them. And you have senior officials, including the CIA director and Vice President Mike Pence, saying that, in fact, we want to eliminate the North Korean regime and undertake regime change. So when they hear this stark change in rhetoric from President Trump, it increases the risk that they may feel the need to go first in a crisis or that any kind of activity that's not explained, a power outage in Pyongyang, a virus that hits their computer systems at the wrong time, may be seen by the North Koreans as a prelude to a first strike, and they may use their weapons for fear of losing them, resulting in a crisis that nobody really wants.
That we could get into a conflict by accident, you're saying?
This is the great risk. I mean, anybody who believes that either the United States or North Korea controls every last piece on the table hasn't paid attention to history. There's always, as John F. Kennedy famously said, someone somewhere who doesn't get the word. So whether it is a low-level military officer, a fishing vessel that strays into the wrong water, some third party could precipitate a major crisis that nobody can control.
What about Kim Jong-un, who is a young leader? He has been described as morbidly obese and possibly addicted to opioids. Is he a rational person that can be dealt with by the United States?
Well, look, I think we have to look at what North Korean behavior has been under Kim Jong-un. We have seen very striking, dangerous activities like the assassination of his brother in Malaysia. But we have not seen highly destabilizing, provocative steps. What we have seen as are demonstrations of their growing missile and nuclear capability, and most of it, not all of it, seems designed to project the fact that they have a deterrent that can keep the United States from eliminating their regime. We haven't seen them try to provoke a crisis as we saw under his father and his father before him. So, you know, rumors aside about, you know, what he does, what he may be addicted to, we have no evidence that suggests Kim Jong-un is anything other than rational. But that's one of the reasons why we need to find a way to engage him directly, if not for negotiations, at least for establishing a deterrent relationship. Because without the direct access and without understanding what it is he's seeking and trying to achieve, we risk stumbling in the dark and at great risk of having a crisis that we're not prepared for and nobody really wants.
That's John Wolfstahl, who is former senior director for arms control and nonproliferation at the National Security Council under President Obama. Now he is a scholar with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. John Wolfstahl, thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Violinist Willie Arteaga. He brought his music to the front lines of Venezuelan protests, often wearing the colors of his country's flag, playing its anthem. Even after beatings, he went back to play. But Arriaga was arrested by Venezuela's National Guard on July 27th and remains in prison. There is, of course, concern for Arriaga, but also for what he's come to symbolize. He was a member of an orchestra affiliated with El Sistema, a state-run music program for impoverished kids that produced superstar Los Angeles Philharmonic conductor Gustavo Dudamel and is copied here in the U.S. Another young musician who was in El Sistema, Armando Canizales, was protesting in June when he was shot and killed. Robert Carmona Boras is a Venezuelan-American lawyer and academic. He's CEO of the nonprofit Arcadia Foundation. And Robert, your group brought Arteaga to the U.S. just this June. Why?
That's correct, Robin. We saw him, you know, playing his violin on the street. He asked us, you know, if we can help him just to come and also encourage the Venezuelan, you know, that are here in U.S., just to keep fighting for whatever they are. That's why, we brought him here to ES.
Well, he met with some members of Congress. Also, as you said, he came to help support Venezuelans like yourself. You came to the U.S. in 2002 seeking political asylum from the then government of Hugo Chavez. And, of course, he's the socialist who preceded the sitting president, Maduro. He's said to be Maduro's mentor. Chavez's revolution, you know, nationalized industries. The intent was to create more equity, call for better access to food. But, of course, there was also corruption. Chavez packed the Supreme Court with his supporters. The country has been unraveling. What was it like for you as a Venezuelan here to see Willy Arteaga, to see him playing, to see him? I mean, by the way, he was beaten. He was injured probably by rubber bullets. He ended up in the hospital at one point. He played his violin in the hospital. There are all these videos of him. What was it like for you to see that?
It was horrible. The more you know that I know him, you know, personally, and he's now, you know, like a son to me, you know, and, you know, he was shot in his face 5 days before, you know, Willie's arrest. Pellet had to be extracted from his temple. You know, he almost lost, you know, his side on the left side of his face.
He was beaten with his violin at one point.
Yeah, you know, Willie tried just to you know, to raise his voice, but in a way that he do best, you know, that was through his violin, through his music, being a symbol in Venezuela of peaceful protest. And now he's being detained.
Well, he's also a symbol of, as we said, this country's pledge to support musicians. Now, the El Sistema program was started by Perez, and it was continued by Chavez, and it came to symbolize the government support of impoverished kids. I know that Willie Arteaga did not come up through the system as Gustavo Dudamel did, but he joined an orchestra at one point, and he's out there with a violin. And like many kids in Venezuela, he started learning to play on YouTube, which many kids did along with El Sistema. You know, there's great debate in the U.S. whether the Sistema programs here in the U.S. should say something. They say they represent music, not a political stand. Gustavo Dudamel, you know, your thoughts about what you'd like to hear from people as Willy Arteaga sits in jail.
Listen, in the case of Gustavo Dudamel, you know, it's like what Gustavo Dudamel is waiting for, you know, for the government just to kill Willy Arteaga, the kid that has been part of the Caracas Youth Symphony Orchestra, is being imprisoned in a very express trial behind closed doors. One of the crimes is possession of an incendiary object. What, his violin is an incendiary object? Public instigation. What public instigation? Music? This is insane.
Well, you know, you mentioned Dudamel, and he has been quiet. His supporters say it's because he's afraid. El Sistema depends on the government. It's precarious, and he doesn't want to jeopardize that. But he did come out and say something after the Sistema violinist Armando Canizales was shot during a protest. And he did speak out, telling the Venezuelan government, enough is enough. Can you sympathize that, you know, all of the musicians and the people who run the programs around the world now are afraid for the musicians and the program inside Venezuela if they say something.
You cannot, you know, you have to stop being afraid of losing monetary support instead of the human value of the people, you know, the musicians that are the one who give life to the sistema.
That is Professor Robert Carmona Borjas, CEO of the nonprofit Arcadia Foundation. They brought Venezuelan violinist Willy Arteaga to the U.S. in June. He is now imprisoned in Venezuela. Much concern for him. Professor, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you so much for having me.
And I can hear all the passion and sadness in your voice, so I'm wishing you the best.
Thank you so much.
And that audio clip you've been hearing all day of President Trump saying that North Korea's threats will be met with fire and fury may have been improvised. That's according to the New York Times. His comments are being defended by some, including Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Here he is on CBS This Morning.
Put yourself in President Trump's shoes for a moment. Where does your allegiance lie? Isn't your primary purpose as President of the United States to protect the American homeland from a nuclear weapon attack by a guy like Kim Jong-un? He's going to pick homeland defense over regional stability, and he has to.
But New York Congressman Elliot Engel, the ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, called the president's remarks unhinged. Military analysts said don't meet violent rhetoric with violent rhetoric. And Secretary of State Rex Tillerson dialed back the rhetoric a bit. Let's bring in our Here Now political analyst, Jamal Simmons, our Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
Start with you. President Trump threatened North Korea with the fire and fury like the world has never seen. His defense secretary also had strong words. But staying with Donald Trump, fire and fury may be improvised. Good move or mistaken escalation?
I don't think it was a mistaken escalation. I think what we saw was the president being exactly who he is, which is someone who is always going to put America first, someone who's always going to put the safety of the American people first, and someone who is not going to be intimidated on a national stage by Kim Jong-un, who thinks that he can say what he wants and do what he wants and fire off these missiles in an attempt to test the president. Every president, first term that comes in, gets tested internationally, and this is President Trump's test, and I think he passed it by showing the world that he's not going to be threatened or intimidated by a radical dictator overseas.
Isn't there a risk, though, Paris, of using that kind of rhetoric with somebody who may be unstable in North Korea?
Sure, there's always a risk, but President Reagan ran the risk when he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," and
well,
meant it. And
people Gorbachev was not Kim Jong-un.
That is true, but at the same time, we're talking about language that's political, that's used on as relates to foreign leaders. This is the same scenario. They told President Reagan, do not use that because it will be inflammatory and it will be agitate the leader. President Trump, a lot of people on the left are saying this wasn't good language, but it was stated today through the Deputy White House Press Secretary that the president consulted with General Kelly and other members of the National Security Team before he made that statement, improvised or not. They knew he was going to use the language fiery, and so they didn't have a problem with it.
So here's the problem. The problem is, you know, before we've been going back and forth over the president's tweets and what he said and what he didn't mean. And, you know, this is when it gets serious. We're talking about nuclear weapons. We're talking about California. We're talking about weapons that could reach other places in the United States and Seoul for sure. We have got to have a presidency that is more disciplined than the one that we are having. We've got to have one where the president's coordinating strategy. The problem with the improvisation is that the generals, the military, the State Department are not all in and ready to follow on the president's statement with diplomatic and military maneuvers. What we need to have is a president who is consulting with his leaders of the various factions of the government and implementing a coordinated strategy, and we don't have that. It is hurting us, and it's putting the entire country at jeopardy.
Well, Jamal, we don't know that it was improvised. You're going off a New York Times statement. The White House said that the president consulted with the General Kelly, the Chief of Staff, and National Security Team.
But not on the actual topic of the tweet or the statement that he made on camera.
No,
they were not informed about the actual topic of the statement. And I think that is the thing. That rhetoric is so hot at a time where we are talking about nuclear weapons, it's just not acceptable.
I'd rather have a president who says what he means and means what he says than have someone like President Obama who had these arbitrary red lines that people like Ahmadinejad crossed and crossed and crossed, and he never did anything about it.
I think it's important
for President Trump to lay the foundation early on as president and say, America will not be deterred. We're going to have the strongest military. And if you think you can intimidate us like you might have done with other presidents. You better think again.
Okay, let's listen to something, because President Trump has actually, as with almost every topic, spoken on this issue before in a slightly different way. Let's listen here to him. In 1999, he was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, and Russert asked about Trump's earlier statements that he would be willing to preemptively strike North Korea. Trump began his response by saying he'd first start with negotiation. Listen to this.
If a man walks up to you on a street in Washington, because this doesn't happen, of course, in New York, but if a man walks up and puts a gun to your head and says, give me your money, wouldn't you rather know where he's coming from before he had the gun in his hand? And these people in 3 or 4 years are going to be having nuclear weapons. They're going to have those weapons pointed all over the world and specifically at the United States. And wouldn't you be better off solving this really potentially unbelievable and the biggest problem? I mean, we can talk about the economy. We can talk about Social Security. The biggest problem this world has is nuclear proliferation. And we have a country out there in North Korea, which is sort of wacko, which is not a bunch of dummies, and they are going out and they are developing nuclear weapons. And they're not doing it because they're having fun doing it. They're doing it for a reason.
Jamal, what do you make of that when you hear President Trump long ago saying that about North Korea and pushing for negotiation?
That the president does not have a coherent strategy to deal with national affairs. The president is a six-year-old when it comes to many of these things. And it
wow.
sounds as if he is coming up with things off the top of his head, depending on whatever it is the moment requires to make him look better. He thinks it makes him strong to say things like this, but in fact, it threatens all of our security. And I just want to say one other thing. We did a poll with a group I work with, Gen Forward Survey, that polled millennials about whether or not they found the president to be honest and trustworthy. And 67% of millennials did not find the president to be honest and trustworthy. Only 14% did. You can't have a government where only 14% of the largest generation of Americans trust the president to do the right thing.
Paris?
He should try to get those millennials to actually turn out and vote. So until they actually turn out and vote in 60% of the election. And
even 62% of white millennials who actually split on President Trump, they still don't trust him.
You know what? I'm not concerned about the millennial vote. What I'm concerned about is the safety of this country. And I think going back to the 1999 tape, what is important to highlight is that this is a president who has been thinking about these issues for quite some time now. And he does have the mindset and the strategy to say, you know what, you can negotiate, but you also can talk tough. They don't cancel each other out.
But you know what, Paris, you said you criticized President Obama, as others have, for drawing red lines, for instance, in Syria, and then not being able to back that up. Isn't this exactly what President Trump just did by lobbing out this threat? You're going to see fire and fury like the world has never seen. And it's not just Democrats are criticizing him. Let's listen to a little of John McCain. He was quick to distance himself. He spoke on Phoenix radio station KTAR yesterday. Let's listen.
The great leaders that I've seen, they don't threaten unless they are ready to act.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that President Trump is ready to act.
Paris, how about that? He did the same thing. He drew a line.
I tell you this, if North Korea threatens the United States and continues on their mission to get a weapon that can hit our shores, the president, the national security team, Department of Defense will be able to retaliate in kind.
What about negotiations? What about diplomacy so that perhaps you don't lose South Korea in the bargain?
You all are assuming that negotiations are not taking place. You all are assuming that will not take place. You all are assuming that the president doesn't have a cohesive strategy.
Well, we haven't heard one.
And why would you hear it? It's not for you to hear. That's just the whole thing. He's already said he's not going to reveal his hand to the media, let alone to the members of the international community, because he has a strategy that is going to work to deter these type of aggressions and always keep America safe.
If we go back and look at things like the 13 days around the Cuban Missile Crisis, you go back and look at the way that President Reagan went with Gorbachev, these were coherent strategies that people
understood. The Cuban Missile Crisis was a coherent strategy? That was the biggest military blunder of JFK's presidency.
Hold on 1 second. People understood who was at the helm, what decisions were being made. They were communicating not just inside their small group, but they were communicating with people outside. These are very complex situations. And Paris, you've been in the White House. You know that these are very complex situations. This is not a time to be firing off the lip. If talking tough was a part of a strategy the president had that was coordinated with his military advisors, maybe it might work. It does not appear to be that is what's occurring.
I have to ask about one other thing in the just minute or so we have left, because it's a very interesting story going on, which is the majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, has criticized President Trump's role in the failure of Republicans to overthrow the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Let's listen.
Now, our new president had, of course, not been in this line of work before, and I think had excessive expectations about how quickly things happen in the democratic process.
Now, that prompted a harsh tweet from Fox News host Sean Hannity. He said, "No, Senator, you are a weak, spineless leader who does not keep his word, and you need to retire." White House social media director Dan Scavino says more excuses. Senate Majority Leader must have needed another 4 years in addition to the 7 years to repeal and replace Obamacare. Paris, is Mitch McConnell in trouble?
It's disappointing for Senator McConnell to make such statements, just to seem like he's going to pass the buck on to President Trump and to make it that it's his fault that he was unable to get the Senate Republicans in line to repeal and replace Obamacare. It's unfortunate.
Do you then think that he might have to go as Senate Majority Leader?
I think that's up to the Senate and up to the will of the people. But I think that if he continues along this path of not getting things done, the American people are going to get really fed up with that, and his leadership is going to be tested. You have to deliver and you have to have results. President Trump is about action. The American people want action, and they want something to happen.
Well, and they say that he's the one who didn't provide the action and bring his own Republicans around. Well, but we'll leave it at that for this week. Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist.
Be safe, everyone.
There's never
let's hope so.
You know, time. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Shares in Netflix fell today after Disney announced yesterday that it's starting its own streaming services and pulling future movies off of Netflix. A Disney ESPN streaming service will start next year, and another service with movies and TV is slated for 2019. So what does this gamble mean for Disney, and will it succeed? Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the Wall Street Journal called Disney the biggest cord cutter Hollywood has ever seen after this announcement. How big a deal is this?
Yeah, I think the biggest cord cutter is the consumer, right? Disney is just following the lead of what a lot of us are doing. I mean, it is a big deal. And Netflix stock took a hit because investors are worried that maybe this is the beginning, you know, that other companies are going to follow suit and content creators are going to increasingly look to keep their own shows and movies on their own platforms, which would make sense given the competition. But interestingly, Disney stock was down too. Now, part of it is the disappointing results and problems with ESPN. But there is an open question, I think, as to whether consumers want all these different streaming services. And I had an NYU professor, Scott Galloway, on my show today, who wrote a book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And he put it in a really interesting way that made me think about this differently. He thinks of them as operating systems, these dominant tech companies as operating systems. We know about Android, we know about iOS. But if you think about Amazon as your consumption operating system, Facebook as your relationship OS, and Netflix increasingly becoming people's sort of entertainment OS, I think the question is, what is it going to take for us to leave those ecosystems, right? Is Disney going to be able to pull us away from that? That's what they're up against, what traditional media is up against. And I think it's a really interesting way to look at this.
Well, and how much does Disney need this to work out, given some of the weaknesses that you're talking about that the company is already seeing?
It's huge. It's their existential question. And the other big problem I just mentioned, ESPN, sports, they plan to do the same thing. They plan to offer a streaming sports service. Now, this is the last anchor for traditional broadcast, right? Millions of us tune in. We watch it live, the playoffs, the Super Bowl. We
and
suffer
we spend,
through the commercials.
We spend more money in our cable bill on ESPN than any other network.
Exactly. Now, and we just mentioned that cover Barron's recently is sports TV is broken. Amazon recently bought the rights to Thursday night NFL games. They paid almost around $50 million for it. Twitter last time paid $10 million. Now, they're going to have some commercials, but their whole point isn't that. Their whole point is to get us into Prime, right? This is going to be offered to Prime subscribers. Mm-hmm. If these companies start opening their massive war chests and going after sports, I mean, look out. Scott said to me, winter is coming, right, for traditional broadcasters. Yeah. This is going to be really tough, and that's going to be a pitch battle. Again, do we go to individual streaming like ESPN to see sports and then go back to Netflix for movies or Amazon for, you know, original Prime, or do we want to stay with those big names claims and the others sort of crumble. It's a tough one.
And is it a better system for us to be subscribing to a lot of different services or to have one that, you know, has everything, but people have problems with that too?
Yeah, and the question, so it's going to be, is the content there, right? Is it good enough? Is it original? And then is the delivery mechanism? Let's not count out, though, these people who have perfected the art of getting us this stuff without glitches, and we saw that with Twitter and some of the other streaming. It doesn't always work. So who can do both? Who has the power to do both? That's ultimately going to decide, I think, who's the winner.
That's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake, still available on cable. Maggie, thank you.
Thanks.
And it's one of the most popular shows on Broadway. Rave reviews, 12 Tony Award nominations, one of the most diverse casts. But Natasha and Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 is closing September 3rd. It's complicated. Pop superstar Josh Groban played Pierre. He left in early July as scheduled and was replaced by Okiriete Onadawan, known as Oak, from Hamilton. But despite favorable reviews for Oak, an African-American, ticket sales tanked. He was asked to step aside for 3 weeks so Broadway legend Manny Patinkin could have a short run and boost sales, then Oak could come back. But social media exploded. Charges of racism on one side, political correctness on the other. Patinkin backed out. The play now folds. Jeremy Girard is Broadway critic for Deadline.com. He joins us by Skype. Jeremy, your take.
I think that what's happened with The Great Comet is in some ways an old Broadway story. You don't sell tickets, you close. And in some ways, it's the most important story about another aspect of Broadway that's going on today, which is how does Broadway, just like Hollywood, deal with issues of race in casting and in hiring onstage and backstage personnel. Here you had a show that only got to Broadway on the strength of a superstar, Josh Groban, joining the cast.
Even though we've seen it, it's an extraordinary show. We'll post our backstage interview with Josh Groban and our interviews with the creators at HereNow.org. It was an instant hit.
There were many, many shows in the history of Broadway that are great shows that didn't work on Broadway. And there are many complicated reasons for this one. It's being sort of hung on the fact that there was a social media backlash against the displacement of Oak by Broadway star Mandy Patinkin, who, once this social media backlash began, Mandy immediately withdrew. He didn't want to have any part in displacing another actor, Oak.
And especially an African-American actor. Some of the tweets and the hashtags. Here's a tweet from Broadway veteran Jackie Hoffman, who said, "In Xanadu, I was replaced by Whoopi Goldberg, not because she's black, but because she sold tickets. Hashtag not about race." But on the other hand, you had actor Rafael Casal. He wrote, "Telling actors of color to hashtag make room, really? At Great Comet, hashtag make room is the new code for still not your turn." And yet, Jeremy, this is a play that won an award for its diversity.
The play won an award for its diversity and was recognized throughout the industry as a paradigm of what we call color-conscious casting and hiring. But none of those make any difference at the box office. And although the box office was great while Josh Groban was there, all the indications were that the tickets were going to fall off after he left, not just the presence of the superstar. The Great Comet of 1812 is an anomalous Broadway show. It was beloved by the critics and beloved by the downtown audience, but the uptown audience was basically the fans of Josh Groban. And unless the producers had hired another superstar, I think if they had brought in Usher, for example, to replace Josh Groban, that show would run into next year.
Well, and they were very apologetic. The creator, Dave Malloy, apologized immediately. He said he just hadn't considered the optics of the switch.
One of the worst word choices, by the way, that I can imagine, calling this really a problem of optics.
As opposed to a problem.
Terrible.
But it is true that he was desperately trying to save the show. And now, not only does Oak not get to play the part, nobody gets to play a part.
Well, that's the tragedy of this show. Many critics, myself included, were champions of this show in its off-Broadway creation leading up to Broadway. And we're all really, really sad.
Well, you can see it till September 3rd. Jeremy Girard, Broadway critic for Deadline.com. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
From a comet that's dimmed to a superstar, and the only thing that could eclipse Glenn Campbell did. He died from complications of Alzheimer's yesterday. When we spoke to him and his wife Kim in 2012, I asked him about his long collaboration with the great songwriter Jimmy Webb on songs like By the Time I Get to Phoenix. Here's what Glenn thought when he first heard Jimmy play it.
Oh, it was great. For me, it was just wow, you know.
Why? What was about it? What did you hear?
I was going back home. By the time I make Albuquerque, and I cried singing it.
By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working.
I left some of it in because it was coming from right here. Because I just wanted to go home and see Mom and Dad. Then, you know, because I got in my old 34, whatever it was, and drove back to Arkansas. Thank God we made it.
So that song struck you, and then you get Wichita Lineman. Oh, my.
Very good song. Jimmy Webb wrote, wow.
Well, that was written specifically awesome for you because you had Phoenix out.
Mm-hmm. By the time
then,
I get to Phoenix,
You were going back in to record another album, and Al DeLore called Jimmy and said, can you write us another one like Phoenix? It was such a huge hit. And so in one day, Jimmy wrote Wichita. And they called him up, and they were in the studio, and they said, is it ready? Is it ready? Are you finished with it? He goes, no, I'm not finished with it yet. He said, just bring over what you got. And that's where the guitar solo came in, because the song was unfinished, and Glenn just finished it off with a guitar solo.
Right, that was right.
That beautiful, it's sort of, da-na-na-na-na-na-na, that solo?
Yeah.
And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time.
Do you tire of a song like Wichita Lineman?
No, I really don't, because it's a chord progression. You know, you could do a play an instrumental with it. Yeah, I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time.
Most famous line in a song of all time.
Yeah. Jimmy, yeah, boy. He's the best songwriter. Wow.
Well, a little while back, we spoke with Jimmy Webb about Glenn Campbell. It was just before a tribute concert for Jimmy that he was turning into a fundraiser for Glenn Campbell's Alzheimer's organizations.
Well, when I was 14 years old, I got down on my knees beside the bed because I'd heard a Glenn Campbell record called Turn Around, Look at Me.
There is someone walking behind you. Turn around, look at me.
And I believe it was perhaps 4.5 or 5 years later that I was driving down the Santa Ana Freeway and heard Glenn Campbell singing By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
It was a magical meshing of talents. I had been writing Glenn Campbell songs in my mind. I was ready for Glenn Campbell.
You know, you mentioned that in the book, you mentioned it as well, you know, politically on different ends of a spectrum. He was not the guy were hanging out with. You're hanging out with Harry Nilsson. And oh, look, there's John Lennon on that Lost Weekend, which we're not going to go into that. But you're not hanging out with Glenn Campbell. But how would you describe, was it a friendship? How would you describe it?
Well, the first thing you ever said to me was, when are you going to get a haircut? And yet, I found out very quickly that there was hardly anyone who could stand on the same level as he could stand as a guitarist and could stand behind me, watch my hands moving on the piano, and just play along on the guitar, which is like a virtual impossibility. Mm. And partially because of the tension, I think, between us. Mm. Out of that came, I think, some of the nicest records of that period.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing.
The main reason I'm doing the concert because he really taught me a lesson in bravery. He taught me a lesson in what it really means to be a man when he contracted that disease and the way he dealt with that.
Okay, now.
And I've grown up a lot since I met Glenn.
I still hear your sea waves crashing.
You know, most of us can say that as well. Jimmy Webb, I'm Glenn Campbell, here and now.
I clean my gun and dream of Galveston. I still see her standing by the water.
It used to be that high schools were held accountable for how many students they graduated, but an increasing number of states judge schools on what kids are doing after they finish high school. In Chicago, Mayor Rahm Emanuel took that a step further when he announced this spring that to get a high school diploma, seniors must have a firm, written plan for what they're going to do after graduation. WBEZ's Sarah Karp visited one public school that's already started doing that.
At Chicago Board of Education monthly meetings, mariachi bands and math decathletes are often central on their agenda. But earlier this summer, a principal was honored because every graduating senior in his Southside school had a concrete plan for their future.
And we think that this is a remarkable feat, and we want
That's
to honor,
Chicago's Chief Education Officer Janice Jackson, talking about Fenger High School and its principal, Richard Smith. Smith says even he was shocked at the accomplishment. When his staff told him it was going to happen, he asked them to prove it.
Sure enough, they showed it to me, and, you know, we had to celebrate because this is something that hadn't happened here in 20 years.
What made this so remarkable is that Fenger is a historically poor-performing school in one of the most violent and impoverished neighborhoods in Chicago. About 60% of Chicago's graduates enroll in college within a year of leaving high school. At Fenger and some two dozen high schools that serve poor students, about a third of the students actually enrolled in college in 2015. This year, two-thirds of the Fenger graduates were accepted and plan to go to college, a goal Janice Jackson says is best for students.
We know that in this global economy that a graduation, that a high school diploma is not sufficient, that students need more schooling beyond high school in order to have access to all of the opportunities that the workforce, you know, will afford them.
But Jackson says Chicago's Board of Ed will accept almost any verified plan, college, a job offer, the military.
We also know that if students have a plan in their back pocket, they're more likely to keep going forward.
Current sophomores will be the first students who have to meet this requirement. There are no details yet on how the school district, with about 20,000 graduates annually, will verify that each one has a written plan. Richard Smith and his staff at Fenger will tell you that making it happen is not easy. Fenger enrolls way fewer students than it once did, but they are also further behind and needier than students of a decade ago. Even though there were only 58 seniors this year, Smith hired two dedicated staff to work on post-secondary plans. One of the biggest criticisms of the city's new requirement is that it doesn't come with money for extra staff.
I mean, we're already on top of this. All he did was put a threat, said they couldn't graduate without it. It's not going to help us.
That's Victor Ochoa. He's a counselor at Schurz High School, a mostly Latino neighborhood high school of about 1,800 students. He says his caseload ranges between 350 and 400 students, and it's difficult to reach everyone. Ochoa says he's especially worried about his undocumented students.
Something like Rahm's new requirement for them, they're afraid that if they're not going to get their diploma because they have not filled out a form, then why try?
Recent graduate Jade Aguilar agrees that for many students, the plan is unrealistic.
This is for an ideal student who lives in a white picket fence and has a mom and a dad and, you know, like they make good money and stuff like that. This is not where I come from, you know.
But at Fenger High School, several incoming freshmen say they aren't afraid of the new requirement. Andre Hale says the mayor is sending the right message.
Obviously, that's probably his way of showing that he cares about the kids and they need a plan to want to push them and aim higher for how they want to live.
Principal Richard Smith says for many, getting a decent job is their best bet, and that Mayor Emanuel needs to address the lack of jobs for young people. Smith and his staff are still working hard with his most recent graduates to follow through on their plans.
Making sure that they had everything in place, calling their parents, and we'll continue to do that throughout this summer.
He says he and his assistant principal will drive some students to college this month and even help them get set up in their dorms. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Karp in Chicago.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.